Hi, I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. This is Democracy Now!
Without sufficient safe water, food and sanitation that only a humanitarian ceasefire would bring, child deaths due to disease could well surpass those already killed in bombardments.
As the death toll in Gaza tops 20,000, including 8,000 children, UN officials plead for a new ceasefire as the humanitarian crisis escalates amidst heavy Israeli attacks. On Wednesday, the UN Security Council was forced to postpone a vote for a third time on Gaza due to opposition from the Biden administration. We'll get the latest. Then to the Colorado Supreme Court's historic decision to bar Donald Trump from the Colorado primary ballot over his role in the January 6th insurrection. And we'll look at Trump's increasingly extreme anti-immigrant rhetoric on the campaign trail.
I think the real number is 15, 16 million people into our country. When they do that, we got a lot of work to do. They're poisoning the blood of our country. That's what they've done. They poison.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Palestinian officials say the death toll from 75 days of Israeli attacks on the Gaza Strip has topped 20,000, nearly 1% of the Gazan population. At least 8,000 children are among the dead. On Wednesday, a World Health Organization emergency team reached the Al-Ahli Hospital, which had been northern Gaza's last functioning medical facility where people could undergo surgery. WHO team coordinator Sean Casey says conditions have further deteriorated with the bodies of the dead placed in rows in the courtyard. Patients who've gone weeks without needed surgery and growing rates of postoperative infections due to a lack of antibiotics.
What we found here is a hospital that's really almost completely stopped functioning. 2 days ago, a number of staff were detained. Just last Saturday, we visited Al-Shifa, and they were telling us how they were sending surgical cases here because Al-Ahli had some of the only operating theaters left in northern Gaza, in Gaza City, and those are now no longer functional. They don't have specialists, they don't have surgeons, they don't have power, they don't have water, they don't have food.
The United Nations Human Rights Office says it's received disturbing information about a summary execution of Palestinians by Israeli forces in Gaza City Tuesday. The UN agency reports that during a raid on a building in the Al-Ramel neighborhood, Israeli soldiers allegedly separated a group of men from women and children, then shot and killed at least 11 of the men in front of their family members. Soldiers then allegedly ordered the women and children into a room and either shot at them or threw a grenade into the room, seriously injuring some of them, including an infant and a child. Meanwhile, Israel continues to attack southern Gaza. On Wednesday, a three-day-old infant was pulled from the rubble alive but injured after Israeli strikes flattened residential buildings in Rafah.
We saved her life at the last moment. We couldn't see her because of the smoke created by the rocket. So we were looking for her. My cousin carried her outside so she could breathe properly. 3 days old, a small baby girl, 3 days old, choked because of the rocket strikes.
The United Nations Security Council has for the third time this week postponed a vote on a resolution calling for a ceasefire in Gaza and for Israel to allow shipments of food, water, fuel and medicine into the besieged territory. Several Security Council members have expressed frustration with the United States for repeatedly delaying votes and for threatening to once again veto any resolution. Meanwhile, President Biden had just a brief response Wednesday when asked by a reporter about the unprecedented death toll in Gaza.
And your reaction to 20,000 dead in Gaza, that death toll reached today?
It was tragic.
French President Emmanuel Macron has criticized Israel's assault on Gaza while repeating his call for a truce leading to a humanitarian ceasefire. On Wednesday, Macron told a French TV news channel, quote, "We cannot let the idea take root that an efficient fight against terrorism implies to flatten Gaza or attack civilian populations indiscriminately," he said. France's health minister tendered his resignation on Wednesday to protest an anti-immigrant bill backed by President Emmanuel Macron and approved by a wide margin in the French parliament. The bill makes it far easier for France to expel asylum seekers, sets strict immigration quotas, makes it harder for children of immigrants to become French citizens, and delays immigrants' access to welfare benefits by several years. Far-right leader Marine Le Pen has called the amended bill an ideological victory for her party. In Brussels, the European Union has agreed to a new pact on migration and asylum that Amnesty International warned, quote, will set European asylum law back for decades to come and lead to greater human suffering, unquote. The agreement comes after 3 years of negotiations. It allows for the detention of migrant families, including those with young children, and fast-tracks the deportation of newly arrived asylum seekers. EU Parliament member Malin Björk said in a statement, quote, in the face of Russia's war of aggression against Ukraine, the EU showed that solidarity with those seeking protection is possible. But instead of building on that experience, the deal just struck will institutionalize and worsen the most repressive practices, mass detention, pushbacks, and cruelty at the borders, unquote. Texas Republican Governor Greg Abbott chartered a flight Tuesday that brought more than 120 immigrants from the U.S.-Mexico border to Chicago. It's a major escalation of Abbott's policy of transporting asylum seekers to Democratic-led cities and comes just after Abbott signed Senate Bill 4, which makes it a state crime to enter Texas outside of a U.S. port of entry. This comes amidst mounting tensions in Chicago over the arrival of migrants from the southern border and a worsening housing and health crisis that faces them. On Sunday, a five-year-old boy staying at a temporary shelter died amidst a spate of illnesses at the facility. Chicago Mayor Brandon Johnson is calling for more resources to support migrant families and an end to the political weaponization of the issue.
Everyone knows that the right-wing extremism in this country has targeted democratically ran cities. And quite frankly, they've been very intentional about going after democratically ran cities that are led by people of color. And their whole motivation is to create disruption and chaos, because that's what that particular party has been about.
NBC News is reporting Chinese President Xi Jinping informed President Biden last month Beijing plans to reunify Taiwan with mainland China. The message was conveyed as the two leaders spoke on the sidelines of the APEC summit in San Francisco in a meeting intended to ease tensions between Beijing and D.C. The Biden administration reportedly rejected a Chinese request to make a public statement saying it supports the goal of peaceful unification and does not support Taiwanese independence. Though the U.S. supports the One China policy, it maintains cultural and commercial ties with Taiwan and supplies the territory with weapons. U.S. citizens freed in a prisoner exchange with Venezuela were repatriated on Wednesday, while released Colombian businessman Alex Saab landed in Venezuela, where he met with close ally President Nicolas Maduro. Saab, who's accused of money laundering via the U.S. and bribery, was granted clemency by President Biden in exchange for the release of 10 U.S. prisoners. Maduro also agreed to free at least another 20 political prisoners. Separately, Caracas also returned fugitive Malaysian defense contractor Leonard Glenn Francis, who's implicated in a major Pentagon bribery scandal. As he welcomed Alex Saab back at a Caracas news conference, President Maduro welcomed the prisoner exchange as a positive step in U.S.-Venezuela relations.
Hopefully the way will be found for a process of respect, equal treatment, and understanding between the United States of America and the Bolivarian Republic of Venezuela. Today a step has been taken that will hopefully contribute to that path.
In Argentina, new President Javier Milei ordered a major deregulation of the national economy Wednesday. The far-right libertarian followed through on his campaign promise, using executive powers to undo or change 300 rules rules. These include eliminating laws regulating rents and preventing the privatization of state companies. Millet also announced measures to deregulate labor, trade, tourism, pharmaceuticals, and other areas. Following the announcement, thousands of people took to the streets in the first public demonstration since his inauguration and his threats to crack down on protests. This is Alejandro Badar, Secretary General of the Socialist Workers Movement.
I think it is clear that there is a government that is determined to apply a brutal adjustment that has already begun, which has rapidly crushed wages. And in order to make this adjustment happen, they are determined to repress and restrict democratic freedoms. It is unbelievable that a march cannot take place in peace because these people have taken the political decision to prevent it by violating our constitutional rights.
India's parliament voted on a number of key bills Wednesday, including contested criminal reform measures, after more than 140 opposition lawmakers were suspended this week in a major crackdown by the ruling BJP party. Opposition leaders accused Prime Minister Narendra Modi of trying to hobble a new political alliance that's challenging the BJP in next year's elections. Karti Chidambaram of the opposition National Congress Party warned after the suspensions, India's parliament is, quote, going to resemble the North Korean assembly. And influential civil rights lawyer, professor, and expert on police brutality, Paul Chevigny has died at the age of 88. As a lawyer with the New York Civil Liberties Union, he founded the Police Practices Project and published two books on abusive policing, including the seminal Police Power, a 1971 case, Hanchu versus Special Services Division. He successfully challenged the New York Police Department's surveillance of political organizations, which at the time included the Black Panther Party and anti-Vietnam War activists. He went on to write about police violence in other countries, including Brazil, Argentina, and Jamaica. As a professor at NYU Law School, he inspired legions of students. Paul Chevigny is survived by his two children, including the filmmaker Katie Chevigny. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
And I'm Nermeen Sheikh. Welcome to our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world. Health officials in Gaza say the death toll from Israel's 10-week bombardment has now topped 20,000, including more than 8,000 Palestinian children. Officials in Gaza say the death toll also includes 97 journalists and 310 healthcare workers. On Wednesday, the political leader of Hamas, Ismail Haniyeh, traveled to Cairo for talks with Egyptian officials about a possible new ceasefire and the exchange of captives. Israel believes about 129 Israeli hostages are still being held in Gaza. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is under increasing pressure to secure the release of more hostages after Israeli forces mistakenly shot dead three Israeli hostages who managed to escape captivity in northern Gaza. The three men, who were all shirtless, were shot as they cried for help in Hebrew while holding up a white flag.
We're joined now by the Israeli journalist Yuval Abraham. His latest article for 972 magazine and Local Call is headlined, "The Hostages Weren't Our Top Priority, How Israel's Bombing Frenzy Endangered Captives in Gaza." Yuval, if you can start off by talking about exactly what you understand happened. Now there is apparently a GoPro on a dog that captured what took place. The reaction of the Israeli public, and then what this means about the Netanyahu administration and how they're dealing or prioritizing or not hostages.
Yeah, sure, of course. So these are three hostages, Yotam, Alon, and Samer. One of them is a Palestinian Israeli, two of them Jewish Israelis, who somehow managed to escape their captivity. We don't know how. And they roamed around Gaza for a few days. They have written in Hebrew on buildings, help in Hebrew. Hostages are released. They have, as you said, communicated the fact they were Israeli captives to a dog that an army dog that had a GoPro camera. And they were, I mean, essentially executed by soldiers. One of them held a white flag. They took off their, they approached soldiers. They took off their clothes to show that they were not wearing any explosives. And soldiers opened fire at them, immediately killing two of them. The commander on the scene realized that they were perhaps Israelis and told soldiers to stop firing. The third captive managed to run back to a building. And when he came out, soldiers shot at him again, killing him. And yeah, I mean, I've heard, I mean, it's being reported as a mistake that soldiers have made. I think that it was not a mistake when they thought they were Palestinians. I mean, clearly you do not, you know, accidentally shoot at somebody who is holding a white flag. And of course, it becomes a mistake when they realize they're Israeli hostages. And it shocked Israeli society. It triggered protests, calling on the Netanyahu government to reach a deal with Hamas to release more captives and hostages. But currently, from the way I am reading both the political situation and the public situation, such a deal seems unlikely for now.
So Yuval, could you explain why you think such a deal is unlikely? And then tell us what the intelligence sources you spoke to for your piece, what they told you about the concerns that hostages had, the fact that you write in this piece that Israeli hostages often said that they were more afraid of being killed by Israeli airstrikes than they were by Hamas.
Yeah, of course. So I think it's unlikely because I think Netanyahu politically is not going to be willing to pay the price that Hamas is asking, which is to reach a more substantial ceasefire or perhaps a permanent ceasefire and to release a lot of Palestinian prisoners, including people like Marwan Baraghouti and Ahmad Saadat, who are considered to be Palestinian leaders, including many Palestinians who are serving long prison sentences in the occupation jails, some of them for killing Israeli civilians. And this will, you know, ruin Netanyahu politically even more than he's already ruined, which I think is why he will not do it and why he is, you know, making it clear publicly that he plans to continue the war for months. And this relates to our investigation at Plus 972 magazine, because we have basically spoken to Israeli intelligence sources who have described how during the first weeks of Israel's onslaught in Gaza, the military knowingly carried out a striking policy, relentless bombardment policy, that not only, you know, decimated Gaza and killed thousands and thousands of Palestinians, but also endangered Israeli captives and hostages. And sources have told me in intelligence that at the time they had very little intelligence as to where these captives were being held, and that the general atmosphere was in the top military commanders is that the hostages are just not a priority, that their safety is relegated in favor of carrying out this bombardment campaign. And As you said, you know, in the end of November, when captives were released from Gaza for the first time, many of them have described being hit by Israeli airstrikes or attacks, describing a fear, you know, this sort of traumatic fear of feeling that the power that is supposed to supposedly protect you is actually a very, very, very big threat to your life. You know, talking about really being on the verge of death. And we know that in some cases, hostages were hit by these Israeli attacks. Now, the conditions in the captivity of Hamas were horrific for some hostages as well. We also cover that in the report. We also talk about testimonies of released captivities and sources inside the military of sexual assault against some of the captives. But a recurring theme in many of the testimonies of the captives is really being terrified from the Israeli airstrikes. And again, it seems that at least for the first few weeks of the war, this was done knowingly, in a sense, by the military.
Well, I mean, quite rightly, there has been a lot of emphasis on the Israeli hostages. But at the same time, you mentioned earlier Palestinian activist and politician Mustafa Barghouti speaking to the BBC this morning. He talked about how Palestinian prisoners are not so much the focus of discussion. Some who were released from a detention center in northern Israel earlier, they said that they were tortured, and some died as a result. He was speaking to the BBC on Thursday.
Yeah,
they told me they were kept more than 1,000 people in detention or concentration camp near Beer Sheva, and they were beaten badly. They were tortured with different methods. Some people were hit with electrical shocks. They also used drowning their heads in the water while they were interrogating them intensively for hours. They are kept in a place which is very cold. They don't have enough clothes, and the food they are given is very little. But the most important thing, that a number of prisoners that they witnessed died because of the beating and torture. Some of them were all people who had diseases, like heart diseases.
So that's Dr. Mustafa Barghouti speaking earlier today to the BBC. And just a correction, the detention center where the Palestinian prisoners were held was in southern Israel, not northern. Yuval, your response.
Yeah, it's appalling. And I've seen these testimonies. I've also seen live testimonies of these Palestinians being released from Israeli interrogation. And honestly, to me, it reminded me of scenes that I saw of Jews in Eastern Europe, you know, in the 30s and 40s. You see their hands are filled with bruises. They were handcuffed for hours. Some of them have died. They spoke about being electrified by soldiers, being beaten by soldiers, really torture. I mean, they you could see on their faces. I mean, it's horrific. And I think that, you know, you've said at the start of the show that now it's more than 20,000 Palestinians who were killed in Gaza, roughly 1% of the population. That's unimaginable numbers. I mean, just to put it in some sort of proportion for audiences in the United States, 1% of the population in the U.S. is 3.3 million people being killed in 75 days. And I agree with you that in a way, I've heard Israeli journalists using the term war crimes for the first time after the three Israeli hostages were killed by soldiers. And obviously, soldiers thought that they were Palestinians, which is why they felt comfortable, it seems, to shoot somebody who is holding a white flag in their hand. And to me, it's really outrageous how there is like two completely different sets of ways we look at the world, not according to the crime, but according to the victim of the crime. Because, you know, how many Palestinians were executed by Israeli soldiers? And how often does that happen without any response from journalists, without using words like war crimes? And I think that really at the heart of a lot of what is going on is this disparity between having some people whose lives have meaning and other people whose lives have no meaning for so many people on the West and in Israel.
Yuval, I wanted to ask you about the number of prisoners being taken by Israel on the West Bank. We're talking about something like 4,000 just since October 7th. Do you have the sense that they are just rounding up people because as they negotiate a prisoner exchange, they'll have more to give back? That's one question. And the other is about Human Rights Watch's report released today, Meta's Broken Promises, Systemic Censorship of Palestine Content on Instagram and Facebook. People being systemically knocked off of Facebook and Instagram if they are posting about what's happening to Palestinians.
Yeah. So, you know, Israel has a longstanding policy of these mass arrests. We've seen them happening in the previous Gaza bombardments, also in 2021. Many of these, I think, you know, thousands of these Palestinian prisoners are held without trial, without charges being pressed against them. Even when charges are pressed, the system of the military occupation and the military judicial system is extremely unjust. 99.4% of the cases end up in indictment. I'm not sure. I mean, I think part of it has to do with getting numbers. It seems very logical. I don't have any inside information about it, but what you suggested seems logical. Again, I think that for the next prisoner exchange, Hamas will insist on releasing much more prominent Palestinian prisoners. So unlike the last time when really, you know, you saw Palestinian prisoners being released after they spent a short time in prison, I think if for a next hostage deal to take place, there will, you know, they will need to have more substantial Palestinian prisoners. And I mean, there is repression online. I know that there are Israeli ministries that are constantly working with Meta, with Facebook, with X as well, and with Instagram, to aid in this process. There have been reports about sort of this mass scanning that Israel does of social media to find posts to flag in a way for these, you know, international social media organizations, and yeah, the repression is taking place. Yeah.
Yuval Avraham, I want to thank you for being with us. Journalist based in Jerusalem who writes for Plus972 magazine and Local Call. We'll link to your new article, The Hostages Weren't Our Top Priority, How Israel's Bombing Frenzy Endangered Captives in Gaza. Coming up on Wednesday, the UN Security Council forced to postpone a vote for the third time in Gaza due to U.S. opposition. We'll speak with Phyllis Bennis back in 20 seconds.
I can see the sun light up the sky, so I hit the road in overdrive, baby.
Blinding Lights by The Weeknd. The artist announced earlier this month he would be directing $2.5 million to meals for Palestinians in Gaza. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
The United Nations Security Council has, for the third time this week, postponed a vote on a resolution calling for a halt to the fighting in Gaza and for Israel to allow shipments of food, water, fuel and medicine into the besieged territory. Several Security Council members have expressed frustration with the United States for repeatedly delaying votes and for threatening to once again veto any resolution.
We're joined now by Phyllis Bennis, fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, serves as an international advisor for Jewish Voice for Peace. Phyllis has written a number of books, including Understanding the Palestinian-Israeli Conflict, her recent piece for In These Times, headlined The Christmas Truce of 1914 and the Demand for a Ceasefire in Gaza. As we went to air today, Phyllis, there is no resolution at this point at the UN. One is expected today, but we said that Monday and Tuesday and Wednesday. If you can talk about what's going on there, and then we can talk about that Christmas truce as we move into the weekend.
This is, in some ways, a very old story. The United States refuses to accept a globally demanded ceasefire in the context of Israeli assaults, particularly on Gaza. And we've seen it before. We're seeing it again now. The U.S. is refusing to allow the term cessation of hostilities. They certainly will not allow the term ceasefire to be used. They want to talk about a suspension of hostilities, meaning just a temporary pause like we saw 2 weeks ago, to allow in a certain amount of aid, reduce the pressure on Israel, get some of the hostages released, and then go back to the Israeli assault and kill more thousands of Palestinians, presumably. So what we're looking at is the question of whether the other members of the Security Council will be able to persuade the U.S., and I think this is very doubtful, to change their position and allow decent language about a real cessation of hostilities or a ceasefire. And if they don't, will the council go ahead and force the United States to use its veto, something the U.S. does not like to do, or will it essentially collapse under its own pressure and simply withdraw the resolution and say, well, we couldn't get the U.S. on board, so we're not going to go forward? The issue then becomes whether you're letting the U.S. off the hook by saying we will simply, we'll simply withdraw the resolution, or do you force the U.S. to use its veto, which then has consequences, including sending the resolution off to the General Assembly, where it passes under very particular conditions that can make it much more influential, and by some arguments by legal scholars,